and welcome to Civility and Solutions, a podcast brought to you by your Court Services section of the Supreme Court of Ohio. I am your host, longtime justice enthusiast, Kate Munger. This is a podcast about inspirational ideas for courts from across our 88 beautiful Ohio counties. The idea of a podcast was conceived as a way to be able to present content that was developed for the 2020 Dispute Resolution Conference. That conference was unfortunately called off due to that land-crushing pandemic called COVID-19. We are using the podcast format today to preserve that valuable content. Today's topic relates to attorney advocacy in mediation. We'll talk about how you can apply the value of thorough preparation for mediation. You'll learn how to ferret out opportunities to partner with the mediator, and you'll discover how to recognize the value and timing of caucusing and seek to overcome impasse. The views expressed by the guest of this podcast don't necessarily express the views of the Supreme Court. We are happy to be able to use this platform to share solutions and challenges with courts and any listeners who want to stay on the cutting edge of dispute resolution and court services issues. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 5. Our topic is attorney advocacy and mediation. Joining me today are two people with built-in fan bases, Professor James Lawrence and Kwame Christian Esquire. Thank you both so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Glad to be here.
Professor Lawrence is an adjunct professor teaching negotiation and mediation at the University of Cincinnati College of Law, the Ohio State University Moritz College of Law, and the Strauss Institute for Dispute Resolution at Pepperdine University. Professor, what differences do you see in law schools today compared to when you went to law school?
I think there is a greater concentration today on professionalism and ethics, which I think is a good thing. And that to me is the major difference. But I would add on the negative side, greater competition between and among students. So there's more tension, I find, in class. Do I have the right answer? What should I expect on the exam? Because they're more concerned about their grade and the ability to acquire a good job.
That makes sense. Professor, you were previously a trial attorney for the National Labor Relations Board and worked for the law firm of Frost Brown Todd in Cincinnati. How did you get into employment law, and what did you learn about negotiation from that job?
Well, the employment law piece was the result of my interactions with Professor Lawrence Herman, from whom I took criminal law, administration of criminal justice, and more importantly, moot court. And on that national team, it turned out that one of the exercises was an exercise dealing with employment discrimination. And I got intensely involved in preparing for that negotiation. And that led to my asking the then dean, Dean Rutledge, if he knew of some opportunity I might pursue. And he said he had a member of the family that was on the National Labor Relations Board. One thing led to another, and I spent the first 5 years in practice at the NLRB in Cincinnati, Ohio, doing labor relations, and then moved on to Frost Brown Todd, expanding it to employment relations.
Interesting. And now, every fall, Moritz students compete in the intramural Lawrence Negotiation Competition, named for you. The winners and the runner-up go to the regional and national negotiation competitions. What do you think about them naming a competition after you? Is it weird hearing your name tossed around the halls of school?
It's amazing what giving people a free chocolate egg cream and a bagel will do for you. And in my case, naming the competition after me was the result of the chocolate cream and the bagel. Other people, I think, do so showing their skill and competence in the area. But I thoroughly enjoy the interest in dispute resolution and the value of training, particularly would-be litigators and actual litigators, that winning isn't always the best outcome, but collaboratively working out an agreement that will satisfy both parties is often better than winning, because the judge can only decide what the law is on the issues involved in the dispute, while the parties can agree to a much broader compromise that would cover issues that don't have a legal foundation, but have a practical benefit to the parties.
Thank you. We are also lucky today to have Kwame Christian with us. Kwame is a best-selling author, a law school professor, and a business lawyer at the firm of Carlyle, Patchum, and Murphy. Mr. Christian, I'm a little nervous to have you on the podcast. I'm a newbie when it comes to podcasting, but you host the top-ranked negotiation podcast in the world, Negotiate Anything. Can you tell us about the experience of being a podcast host and what you've learned from hosting Negotiate Anything?
It's been a lot of fun. And I think the thing that I really appreciate about it is that every time I have somebody on the show, I'm learning something new myself. Every single time. And we are about 215 episodes in at this point. So it's a selfish pleasure, because I really enjoy learning for myself. And what a lot of the listeners have said is that they appreciate the genuine glee that I get from learning, because a lot of times I ask the questions that they themselves would have asked if they were there. So it's been a fun experience. And it was a great way to build the brand of the American Negotiation Institute. And it led to a lot of training and business opportunities too. So it was all around a very good experience.
I'm understanding that as well. Just being able to talk to all these mediation professionals has been amazing through doing the Supreme Court podcast. You've advocated that building rapport is important in negotiations. Have you honed that skill even further by doing podcasts?
Absolutely. It's a really great exercise, because the things that made me a better podcast host also made me a better negotiator. So listening more effectively, asking better questions, and truly seeking to understand has been incredibly beneficial for me as a negotiator for my clients, and then also as a mediator as well. So it's been really fun to see how those skills coalesce and create just a better overall professional experience.
And just to make us all feel like we need to be a little more ambitious, you're also the director of the consulting firm you mentioned, the American Negotiation Institute. How did you get the idea to found that? And what's the focus of the consulting firm?
Yeah, so I wanted to find a job that was perfect for me. So I said, well, you know what, let me go ahead and just make it. and it worked. And so 4 years later, now we have a team. I have a chief operating officer, several interns, an assistant, somebody who handles PR, somebody who handles finances, all of those things. And really the systems and structures that we have in place are the things that allow me to go out and do some of these fun projects, like joining the law firm of Carlyle, Patchen & Murphy, practicing business law, teaching at Ohio State in the law school, teaching at Otterbein in their MBA program, working with LinkedIn to put on courses. It's been a lot of fun. And I really have to credit the team, because if I didn't have that home base secured, then I wouldn't be able to go out and do all of these other fun things too.
You're like developing your own like brand and just making your own ticket. It's amazing. It's awesome. What's next for the American Negotiation Institute? What's in the cooker?
Well, I've got a couple fun things coming down the pike. So I have three publishers that have offers that I need to consider for my next book, How to Have Difficult Conversations About Race. And so what I'm doing is taking the mediation and negotiation skills and helping people to have the conversation, not teaching people what to think about race, but more how to talk about it, because we've all at least seen conversations on the topic that have gone very poorly. And I wanted to try to take some of these skills and help people out with that.
That's great.
And if I may chime in just a moment on Kwame's point, I have that same interest, and I just am working on an exercise which will be on the Harvard PON program on negotiation website, dealing with the Me Too movement and Black Lives Matter, where each of the two principal parties, the woman victim, has a Me Too issue first and foremost in her mind, and the premier dancer for the New York City Ballet has the same interest, but in the Black Lives Matter, since he is African-American, and the exercise is grounded in the new play that opened on February 20th in New York City, the reimagination of West Side Story, in which the harasser is playing the part of Bernardo in West Side Story, and the victim resents his having a major role, having harassed her. That's the guts of the exercise, but it deals with two very vital issues in the world today, and Kwame and I are working on the various sides of those two movements.
Yeah, and we had the opportunity to demo that one during class this time around for the first time, and the students really appreciated it because it dealt with some critical issues. And so that was a good way to bring what people are seeing in the news and experiencing day to day in their everyday conversations and put it into this framework within the context of class. And so that exercise was really, really powerful.
That's amazing. I do a ton of local community theater, so this could not be more interesting to me. And all the discussions about race and casting for musical theater, even, it's becoming such a topic that people are desperate to know more about. So that's great. I love it. And how do you two know each other? Because there's a rapport. It seems to go back a few years.
Yes.
Kwame was my student in, was it 2012?
Yeah, I think 2011 was the first year, and then 2012 too.
And then he passed the course. I think he only got an A.
Yay.
But considering our current involvement, I've talked to the dean, and I think it's going to be raised to an A+. Not that he needs the additional credit. And then we connected when I was looking for a teaching assistant, a collaborative teacher, really a partner in teaching for the dispute resolution program at the Moritz College of Law. And Kwame presented himself, and one thing led to another, and we've been doing it now 3 years or 4 years. It's been a number of years where we collaborate in the presentation of the program, which I think the students really respect, because with two professors involved, they get more personal attention to concerns that they have in the course of the workshop.
Yep. Yeah. And so for me, Jim was the person who introduced me to negotiation. And since I have a background in psychology, that's where my undergrad degree is in. And so I was trying to find psychology in the law. Where could I find it? And it wasn't until I took the class with Jim that I found it. And then I became obsessed. And now it's such a major part of what I do. And so you blend that with the respect that I had for him going through it, and now mutual respect and teaching together. And then you add about, probably conservatively speaking, 10 to 15 trips to Waffle House together, and the relationship is secured.
So you are both set to present about attorney advocacy at the Dispute Resolution Symposium. Are you both ready to try that topic on podcast format today?
Let's do it.
We are.
Let's do it. All right. So to start this, you would advocate partnering with the mediator. So let's start by talking about what you mean by partnering with the mediator as an attorney for a client.
Yes, the partnering with the mediator is really the heart of this particular presentation, because so many litigators are confused about the difference between litigation and mediation. And when they're in mediation, they're really thinking that the mediator is going to be a judge that will be deciding the dispute, when actually he or she is facilitating the dispute to reach a out-of-court outcome. And the litigator particularly needs to understand that he or she is not presenting their side of the case, but rather partnering with the mediator to bring them through to a good agreement. The key here is that it's not a matter of winning, it's a matter of the two advocates were unsuccessful in working it out together, or maybe didn't even try to work it out together. So they're bringing in the mediator to facilitate a negotiation that either didn't occur or more likely did occur but was not successful. So the mediator is facilitating, and the litigators need to know that they should be not giving it to the mediator to decide, which of course the mediator doesn't do, doesn't have the power to decide it, but rather partnering with the mediator to seek his or her assistance in bringing them to agreement. Kwame?
Yeah, and just to add to that, I think really what changes is all in the approach. When you shift your mindset and think to yourself, okay, I'm partnering with the mediator, I'm working with the mediator in order to accomplish something. And that something is we're trying to edge closer to a deal. We're trying to get a better understanding of the other side, those type of things. Sometimes deals aren't meant to be made, so we can't say the successful outcome of every mediation is a completed deal, but at least we're supposed to be moving in the right direction. And so just that shift in mindset will change the behaviors that come as a result of that mindset. And so it's going to change the way that you interact with the mediator. It's going to change the way that you interact with opposing counsel. And most importantly, it's going to change your tone. You're not going to be as positional throughout the process. You're going to be focused more so on the interests, which is the why behind what it is that you're asking for. And then similarly, we're going to try to get that answer from the other side as well. We're going to empathize and try to get a better understanding of what it is they need and want and why it is that they want it. So it puts us in a better position to be creative throughout the process.
And Kwame, as a lawyer, how do you quickly develop a productive working relationship with that mediator? How do you clue them in that this is going to be a partnership?
I think you just have to be explicit and say it and say, I'm looking forward to working with you to try to make this situation a little bit better. I'm looking forward to working with you to get a better understanding of the other side and see if there's anything that we've missed. And for me, having been in that mediator's perspective, I can tell when a lawyer is trying to work with me versus just kind of dominate the interaction. You can tell pretty early. And I think it's important to signal that desire very early to the mediator, because it builds rapport, creates a little bit of trust. And when they trust you a little bit more, they'll give you a little bit more room because they don't think you're going to do anything to sink the entire process. So I think just being clear about your intentions up front, that's going to be really helpful in the interaction.
And Professor Lawrence, is there anything you need to do to prepare your client to let them know you're going into it like this?
Absolutely. You need to let the client know, the advocate should let the mediator know, but the mediator may already be presenting it, that this is a collaborative process and that the mediator is going to facilitate the discussion. We are not out here to simply present our case, but rather to work with that person. And that discussion, as Kwame said, has to be explicit and generally early on, because there are litigators that don't know that distinction. There are also many clients that are not understanding the difference between litigation and dispute resolution. And there are a lot of pieces to this puzzle that need to be set early on. For example, let me give you the obvious one. The mediation agreement, part of which is generally to present a pre-mediation paper. And the mediator should be telling everyone, if the litigator hasn't already said it, that the position statement should not be exchanged. Because if it's exchanged, three quarters of it is the why we should win and you should lose. But rather, if it's not exchanged, the drafter is more likely to say what the dispute is about and what issues remain to be resolved, and maybe even suggesting an option that the litigator hasn't presented yet, but is a viable option. The statement now isn't 20 pages, 15 of which is advocacy as you would write a trial brief, but rather much shorter, but presenting the issues. And that's just a start which the client needs to understand. I'm not presenting my opening argument to the judge or the jury. I'm giving the mediator some understanding of what the mediator is about to engage in.
Now, I feel like a lot of litigators might come into a mediation feeling that this is the mediator show and the mediator is going to do all the preparation and the homework. Is that a mistake?
It's a mistake. Kwame, let me hear your take on that.
Yeah, anytime you're not doing a good job of preparing, it is a mistake and it's your fault.
Yes.
So, I think that's a simple way to put it. I think a lot of times people don't come in as prepared because in the minds of litigators, they didn't see themselves as litigators having a civil conversation with a mediator. When you're a little kid and you dream about being a litigator, it's going up and laying out zingers in a courtroom, right? And so I think when it comes to the mediations, oftentimes the lawyers aren't as prepared as they would be for a trial. They wouldn't have taken the time to go through a rigorous preparation, think through what they would say and how they would say it, those type of things, in the same way that they would for a trial. And I understand there's a different level of severity because if you're at a trial, that's the end point of it. Of course, maybe you have appeals, maybe not, but in mediation, you still have a second shot. But regardless, we can tell as mediators, we can tell when somebody hasn't taken the time to prepare effectively. And so I think it's really the responsibility of the attorneys to make sure they prepare effectively, thoroughly, and give the process and the mediator and the clients the respect that they deserve by taking the time to prep.
And a advocate that is going to be successful in mediation will tell the client something like this: the other side has just said, I'm making it very simple, I need $1 million before I settle this case. And the mediator is then saying, it's the litigator hopefully saying to his client, I'm not going to say, you're out of your mind. That is the dumbest proposal I've ever heard. Rather, the litigator is going to say, oh, let me know how you came up with that number. And then when the other side is saying how he came up with that number, what's the basis for that? Are there any other things you've considered other than simply a financial settlement? Rather than criticizing what the other side is saying, trying to understand what the other side is saying, we call that active listening. Often the client will respond in the preparation, I thought you were representing me. What's this stuff about active listening? And then the litigator has to tell his or her client why this is being done this way. I'm not trying to show the areas of our disagreement. I'm looking for a path to working things out. And to get to that path, I need to understand why they're thinking the way they are so that I can be creative in coming up with some other option, whether it's the simple case of less than $1 million or there's something else, again, making it terribly simple, where a apology for the wrongdoing, making it very sincere, and maybe even in a public dispute, making it public, the apology, may give sufficient comfort to the other side that they're willing to take less than $1 million because they've been freed from whatever attached to the dispute in the beginning by a sincere apology. I'm making it terribly simple, but that's what a advocate in mediation should be doing keeping in mind that the advocate is not winning a case in court, but is trying to solve something.
Right. And you're saying, oh, sorry, go ahead, Kwame.
Oh, and I was going to say, you were recognizing here from the example that Jim just gave, that a major part of the preparation process is coaching. It's coaching your client to give them an understanding of what it is that's going to be coming down the pike. And really, as an attorney, we're not just tasked with representing our clients zealously and doing the best for the clients. We also need to do a good job of convincing the clients that we are representing them zealously and doing the best for them. Because in the example that Jim gave, if the client thinks that this is going to be more like a litigation type of interaction, and you're being respectful and listening and not barking at somebody from across the table, then they might ask themselves, what are you doing? I thought I hired you to defend me. But if you let them know beforehand, then it's not as jarring of an experience, and they can recognize what you're doing as high level lawyering rather than capitulation.
It's interesting that advocates that are not experienced in mediation will often show up at the mediation with their client and have no preparation, which is a mistake. The need for the preparation is clear. And let me give another example. Invariably in preparation, the client will bring up, "That's confidential. I don't want them to know that." And you need then to pursue that as the advocate in preparation by saying, why is it confidential? If we don't reveal something like that, are we going to have a much more difficult time working this out? The client may give some pushback. The advocate then has to say, maybe there's a time at which we will be able to reveal the confidential information, but maybe we need to build some trust first before we can reveal that information. Or maybe we can reveal that information, but we'll get a confidentiality agreement where the other side will agree not to reveal that information and have a written agreement to that effect. A wise advocate, particularly if it's in preparation, will be saying there are different ways to accomplish revealing confidential information other than just saying we're not going to do it because we say you have a right not to reveal it. But are you going to reach agreement? And if discovery is still going on, they may be able to discover that confidential information anyway, whether you declare it as confidential or not. So the advocate needs to be let the client know that there are many different ways of getting to yes, Roger Fisher's great line. There are ways to do that, and you can't look at it as they're going to give up after an hour, because rarely do they.
Now, staying in the same vein, do you have any other advice for an advocate preparing for mediation?
Kwame, other thoughts on that?
I think we covered the main things. I think it's just taking the time to recognize again that this process is different from litigation, but it still requires and deserves your respect through preparation and coaching. The coaching piece is something that's often overlooked, even by people who take the time and prepare effectively. If you don't coach your client through it, then you're going to have some problems too. So I think we pretty much covered it.
There's one piece that I would add to your question, Caden, that is, the client may think, you're my attorney, I'm going to let you speak. And the attorney should be saying, yes, I am your attorney, but I want you to speak. I want them to be aware of the sincerity with which you're taking your position at the moment, the importance of the resolution. We'll talk about when you speak and what you should say, but I want you to participate actively. And then we have signals that if I think you're going off course, I'll, in a polite, discreet way, interrupt you so that you're not doing something that I think is counterproductive, but that I want you as the client to be involved in this, particularly showing the sincerity of positions you're taking rather than simply having the paid lawyer do what he's paid to do, which is to advocate that position.
And possibly an attorney who's playing too much of a role could even hamper the mediation from moving forward.
Yes. Yes. Well put. And that is because the attorney, by being so strident, may be either creating barriers to resolution or reinforcing the other side's knowledge. I told you this wasn't going to work out. We need to get to a jury trial. So you're absolutely right. The attorney has to view this as a process by which we will reach an agreement satisfactory to both parties, obviously satisfactory to our client, but sufficiently satisfactory to the other side that they'll say, okay.
I won't take credit for that idea. I learned that from your article, Advocation Advocacy, Partnering with the Mediator, from the Ohio State Journal on Dispute Resolution.
So I remember that from you. And your grade is going up. As we speak.
So moving into an opening statement in mediation, if you're partnering with the mediator as a litigator, what's the wrong way to go into an opening statement? Can you mess up the tone if you do that wrong?
Yes, you clearly mess up the tone. As the handout that I think many of our viewers may have already received, you can start by saying, they harmed us by doing so-and-so. We're right, they're wrong. The law or the contract clearly favors us. We're entitled to damages and we demand, and then put in the number or whatever you're demanding, is the way a litigator may start in an opening argument to the jury. But in mediation, it is better to be starting out by saying, we want you to know what our interests are, and here are the interests that we have. We are willing to come up with options to satisfy our interests. By the way, we want to know when it's your turn to speak what your interests are, or if they've gone first. We appreciate your telling us what your interests are. This is something we need to pursue further. I want to understand why you're pursuing those interests, because that will make it more useful. And that's the way. There are other examples, particularly where it's a relationship issue and there's a desire, whether it's a domestic husband and wife or whether it's a business relationship where there's a dispute between the employee and his or her employer. We would like, if the dispute is over a suspension, let's say, we'd like to maintain and improve our relationship. Or if it's a case of a discharge, there may be something we should discuss about whether reinstatement might be a possibility. Maybe that's something we should be talking about. And again, you need to tell your client, if you are a good mediation advocate, that by suggesting these options does not indicate we're going to agree with them. We're just showing you that we're open-minded about it. But you have to tell the client sometimes 3 or 4 times, simply because I mentioned something doesn't mean we're going to agree to it. It's just showing that we'll consider anything. That's why the response to, I want whatever I said, $1 million. It's not, hell no, you've lost your mind. It's, oh, where did you come up with that number? Well, it's what we want and it's none of your business. Well, I want to know, and my client wants to know where you came up with that number. Well, I'm not going to tell you. Well, it's certainly you're right not to do this, but it would be useful to us if we knew the basis for it. And you go on, and maybe you don't ever get the answer, but you're showing the other side that you're listening. You want to understand. You're not being sneaky. We, Kwame and I, often use the word transparency. We want to show that we as the advocate are transparent, that our client is transparent, which doesn't mean we're going to give in. It just means we're going to listen and try to work through it. Kwame?
Yeah, I think you pretty much covered it. Again, it goes back to what we mentioned at the beginning with the tone. As long as you are mindful of the discrepancy or the difference between interests and positions, what you say you want versus why you want it, and as long as you're willing to engage in some active listening when you're hearing the opening statement from the other side, I think it puts you in a much better position. But again, the proper behavior will flow from the proper mindset.
Now, I assume a lot of people listening to this podcast will be mediators or neutrals. Looking at this from the side of the neutral, what do you do when you're faced with a litigator who comes into a mediation looking to posture in front of their client with "we're right, they're wrong" language coming in? How do you diffuse that?
Something that I've done in the past is I like to separate the lawyer from the client, not for a long period of time, but sometimes if it gets a little extreme, I just say, "Hey, can we have some lawyer to lawyer talk just for a couple of minutes?" and that allows them to kind of, they can shed the pressure, the performative pressure that comes with posturing for your client. It's like, "Hey man, okay, it's just you and me. We can talk. You're not going to impress me. All right, let's just talk." And when you remove that audience, a lot of times you can get a little bit clearer communication. And sometimes the thing is, they might say, "Listen, my client, they feel really strongly about this, and they need me to present in this way. But it's tough for me to get my client to adjust positions. I recognize that the client needs to adjust, but they're not listening to me. Can you help me to get my client to adjust?" Okay, see, now we're making some progress. And so then I could come in and play that role to have that conversation with the client. So it allows them to still be the macho defender lawyer that they're trying to be, but we can still get the point across. And so sometimes just changing up the pattern of communication helps. And I know I'm more of a fan of shuttle diplomacy than I think Jim is. And Jim, you can jump in and correct me if I'm wrong there. But I found, at least for me, it's easier for me to control the flow of the conversation and get beyond the posturing nature when the person is just with me one-on-one.
I really do agree with you as a generality, Colin, with what you just said, but I like to separate out the dispute to where relationship is or isn't a critical factor. Where it is, let's take the obvious one, a couple is separated. The question is whether they're going to divorce or get together again. Their ability to talk to one another in a joint session and the lawyers shut up is going to be valuable to any possibility of their joining together again, because you are facilitating the discussion that they are beginning to have and maybe interrupting politely at time to time and say, "Would you explain to Sally, why you feel that way?" Give her the background. So you're facilitating that discussion. Another dispute that is clearly two corporations that are having some disagreement about the interpretation of the contract between them may be much less tied to relationship and much more than likely to benefit from what you're describing, which is the shuttle diplomacy. But even then, and it's the example that we obviously give in Cincinnati all the time, Procter & Gamble has a dispute with a supplier because the supplies came late and they're threatened, or in fact have already eliminated the supplier. You have to talk in this case with Procter & Gamble. Isn't there some benefit? Well, they were a very good supplier, and we liked the quality of what they were supplying to us. the ingredients for the toothpaste or whatever it happens to be, but they didn't deliver it on time. Well, if they made some commitment to you to do so, might you consider continuing to have them as your, well, Mr. Lawrence, maybe so, but at least there's a relationship issue there. All of a sudden, P&G is thinking, gee, if we can get them to shape up on their delivery or put penalties if they deliver it late, we'll still use them as a supplier. And that requires the clients to talk to each other and renew the trust that they had lost due to the supplier's late delivery. But Kwame, I think your default is where I am too, particularly in the beginning, where the parties aren't talking. The negotiation they had failed, and now you're trying to rebuild the trust through subtle diplomacy, and all of a sudden you're saying to one side or the other, you know, I understand what you're saying. Do you think there would be some value in the way you've calmly explained it to me, to calmly explain it directly to the other side so they're hearing it from you rather than through me? And the timing of that is critical. And it may not be for several hours or even days before you get to that point. But all of a sudden the client is saying, oh, yes, I'd be willing to tell them really what I told you. And I say, I think that would be more beneficial than my parroting your words to them as your paid lawyer, but you're telling it to them directly.
Is there anything else you would want to tell people about the mediation process and how to prepare for that as an advocate or as the mediator, just getting people together, you know, as far as, do we introduce a caucus? Do we not? What goes in your mind and how? I have 80 questions right now. Go back to the process. And just looking at it from the side of the process from an attorney and from the side of the mediator, what importance does that play?
Well, as Kwame and I have already agreed upon and teach, the mediator has to be transparent also. And one of the things that we say at the beginning is, here is the process I suggest, a pregnant pause. Let's try this out. If you're uncomfortable with it, let us know. We can change the process. It is not rigid. My process doesn't always work in every situation, and we make changes. So let's just take Kwame's example as a good one, that we're not even going to have introductions. We're going to start in caucus and shuttle diplomacy because the parties, it appears, can't stand each other. So you start in separate caucuses and learn from them where their interests are. And then at some point you say, let's have a joint session, but this is the points we're going to bring across. We're going to listen to the other side, and you set it up, and maybe then you have more joint sessions and fewer caucuses, or you decide that, gee, that caucus didn't work out. I had to break them up after 3 or 4 minutes because they were going after each other's throats. So we go back to what Kwame has said, to the shuttle diplomacy. And maybe 2 hours later, we get to have the caucus again. You need to be flexible, and you need to tell your client that what works in some cases doesn't work in others. We're not locked in, and you're telling the other side, if you are uncomfortable with this process, let me know, and let's discuss doing it some other way. Kwame?
Yeah, I agree completely. And I think that's the key. The key word is flexible. You have to be flexible, and you need to let the other side know, or the parties and the clients, whoever's involved, let them know that it is a flexible process. And the thing is, if they trust you, they'll go along with what you say. And it's only a handful of times where people have pushed back on the process that I suggested. Usually it's somebody who says, oh, we're starting off in shuttle diplomacy. I thought I was going to have an opportunity to talk to them face-to-face. I really want to talk to them face-to-face. For me, that's a red like a lot of times if somebody is saying that they really want to talk to them with their eyebrows down and they seem to be seething, I'm like, I don't know if I want you to talk to them. So usually in my experience, the more eager they've been to talk to the other side, the more problematic it's been. And that's not obviously in every case, but sometimes it can be a red flag. And I tell them, listen, if we make enough positive progress, if we have some positive momentum, and I'm taking the temperature of the rooms and I feel like we can do this, then we'll do this. But I need to make a read first. I just don't have enough info. And usually when I say that, they say, okay, that's fine. Let's start off in shuttle. And they go along with it. So even if people resist the framework that you put in place, it's the resistance is minimal.
And Kwame and I avoid using four-letter words, but Kwame used a five-letter word that was right on point. And that word he used was trust. The mediator must establish his or her trust that he is going to listen to both sides. He is a neutral, but he's going to listen and suggest options. It must build the trust. If one side believes, well, Lawrence is favoring the other side's point of view, they've somehow hooked him into their camp, you are not going to be an effective mediator. You need to build trust with both sides, however strongly you may feel that one side has the stronger argument or the more reasonable option. You have to maintain trust or you cannot do your job. And the more trust you have built with both sides, the more they're likely to be listening to you and see that an option that they hadn't considered, but that you had suggested may well work for them.
Looking at attorney advocacy in a caucus, how much information and what type of information as the attorney should you be giving to a mediator in a caucus? Are there any pitfalls to watch for?
Well, so much of that is built on the trust issue that you have developed before you are making that decision. Mm-hmm. And the client may not even be sharing with the mediator information and then may get to the point that they share it, but they say, don't tell the other side. And then the mediator doesn't say immediately, well, I have to, or well, I should, mm-hmm. but accepts it because the mediator is now getting information.
It's like and a ballot.
Later on, which maybe what do you do? Later on, what you told me at 1:30, it's now 4:30, what you told me at 1:30, I think the other side needs to hear. Oh, but it's confidential. And then you go on to what we discussed a few minutes ago. But you've built the trust that the client is then, the client is willing to have the mediator share or have the attorney share it with the mediator on some conditions.
Well, and a trust to the mediator too of you as an attorney that you're going to be participating and that you're here in good faith and you're offering the right things too. Can see that trust going both ways.
Yeah, the five-letter word that Kwame used is so, so critical. And the mediator has to not only build it toward him or herself, but has to get the parties to realize that this process is based in part on trust, and that often confidential information, you have to say and apply sort of way, is going to come out in discovery anyway. So how can we share some of that, maybe a piece of it, and let's see what happens to that piece. The client, I have to just make something up off the top of my head. The other side doesn't know that there's a witness. Doesn't even know there's a witness. So maybe you end up getting the client, getting your client to let the mediator say that there's a witness, but not say who that witness is. It's a step. And then the other side says, well, who is it? Who is it? Well, we're not prepared at this point to divulge that person for this reason or that reason, but we wanted you to know that there is, in fact, a witness to this issue.
So
that may take many hours before you even get to the point, because the client may be saying to the litigate, to the advocate, I don't want them to know there's a witness. We're going to surprise them at trial with this witness. Well, you're not going to surprise them at trial because you have to reveal your witnesses before the trial. But you're going to be spending thousands of dollars between today and that point, maybe to no value to you, other than you've spent now thousands of more dollars in discovery before you've revealed not only that there is a witness, but what is her name is.
And as a lawyer, if you do trust this mediator, if that's been built through this process or for, you know, multiple sessions with other clients, Kwame, I wanted to ask about avoiding reactive devaluation in a case. And if you trust the mediator, how you can kind of get around reactive devaluation happening. So I had to look that up as a term in preparation for this. And just for everyone else out there who doesn't know what reactive devaluation is, it refers to the fact that the very offer of a particular proposal, if it comes from the adversary, it can diminish its apparent value or attractiveness to the other party just because it comes from the other side. So can you talk about how a mediator can help you to present proposals?
Yeah, and so this is really powerful, knowing this concept and understanding how to work around it is going to be powerful. And we can talk about it in mediation, we could talk about it in life in general. And the easy way that I remember the term reactive devaluation is, I call it the just because you said it, I don't believe it bias. So you think right. about a teenager, you might be the parent, and then you tell the teenager to do something and the teenager says, no, that's not cool. And then somebody else does it, says it, and they're like, yeah, that's cool. It's like, kid, I just told you that. Why? Because you said it. That was the problem. And so sometimes you just need somebody else to float the offer in real life and in the mediations. And in the mediations, the mediator can be that person. And so what the person could say, what the attorney could say is, listen, I think I have a good offer, but the other side doesn't really trust me. And I understand that it would be helpful if you could float this as maybe a suggestion, as something you think that could work, if you in fact do think it could work. And that's happened before. And sometimes it might be an offer that's really creative that I didn't think of. And I say, I think that has some legs. Let's try it out. And it really helps when people feel as though it comes from the mediator more so than the other side, because at least now you've given that idea the opportunity to truly flourish in the minds of the other side, because otherwise they'll just close their mind to it and say, no, I'm not even interested in considering that. And I'll immediately counter. But if I just say, hey, out of curiosity, what do you think would happen if we tried it this way? Okay, now we can have a bit of a dialogue and they're more open to considering the possibility.
Well, I should say first, I agree with what you have just said. And there's something I need to add to that, but letting our listeners be aware that the idea being floated, as you put it, is so valuable that it will be considered as an idea without attachments as to who said it.
So it sounds like reactive devaluation or counteracting reactive devaluation by using the mediator might be one way to handle an impasse in a case. Are there any other recommendations you have as a for attorneys to handle an impasse when you're in a mediation?
Well, offshoot of reactive devaluation may be the making of a conditional proposal where the mediator is permitted to say to the other side, if I got the other side agreed to X, would you accept X? Or even further, if I got the other side to agree to X, would you accept X and also Y that you've mentioned? Again, it's what Kwame has discussed on reactive devaluation, but putting it in a conditional offer. The mediator knows the other side is going to go along with X, but they put it conditionally. If I got them to agree, I'll work for you. But he already knows they're not going to agree. But if I got them to agree, would you agree? Or would you agree and do something more? Those approaches are offshoots of Bob Mnookin is the Harvard professor that has written extensively about reactive devaluation. But that is what he suggests mediators should be doing, as I think Kwame used the word earlier, suggesting something. If I do something, would you do something else? Not say, what would you do, but rather giving the idea of what they might do if I got them to agree to X. That's just an approach that, particularly in Kwame's view of the shuttle diplomacy, where you are going from one room to another, and that's one thing you can do of value from one room to another.
What are some other things that you as a lawyer can do to affect how well the mediator will help you? We've already talked about active listening and establishing our credibility with the mediator and seeking the mediator's advice on reactive devaluation and how to address settlements. Is there anything else that you wanted to bring up about what a lawyer can do to help me help you?
Professionally sucking up.
Never hurts.
Professionally sucking up, letting the mediator know that you are willing to have the mediator suggest options. Because the mediator probably, if he's any good, or she is any good, has some other things in his or her mind. And you're telling the mediator, what do you think? Do you have any things I should consider? You're getting the mediator to work for you, but you're showing respect for the person. He's not just a message carrier from room to room or in a joint caucus saying, it's your turn to speak. Now it's your turn to speak. Is not just doing that, but is an active participant in the process. And if you have employed a good mediator, they have the skill to make suggestions. That may not be the first one out of his or her mouth, brilliant, but they're participating. Kwame, your thoughts?
Yeah, actually, my answer wasn't going to be very much different from yours, Jim, because really, for me as a mediator, I'm looking to see whether or not you respect me and the process. And you show that respect by preparing, you show that respect by trusting the process and being willing to be led by the mediator. And the reason we're bringing this stuff up is because it doesn't always happen. It seems like it should be obvious, but it doesn't always happen. We can tell somebody who says, all right, I'm here because the court told me to be here and nothing else. We can get that vibe very, very quickly. So demonstrating respect for the person and the process, the mediator and the process, by being prepared, by being engaged and being respectful, that goes a very, very long way.
And you reminded me, Kwame, of something by what you just said that would come about in preparation, where the client is thinking to him or herself, I'm here because the court wanted me to be here. And one of the questions that the mediator would be asking, even if the advocate hasn't brought it up, is, do we have people here that have settlement authority? Because if we are approaching agreement, but we don't have a person with settlement authority, and they go away thinking about it, they come up with reasons why that won't work, invariably that happens. So the question is that question, which may result in, well, yes, but Billy Bob is in Salt Lake City, and he's going to be in Salt Lake City for the next 2 months, and it's really his decision to make. I can only recommend it. And then the mediator has to get involved, or the attorney, if the mediator hasn't thought about it, get his client to understand that Billy Bob has to be available on phone or video that day so that Billy Bob can give his authority or not, obviously initially privately to the client, but can be involved then and there. Not, well, I'll get in touch with the person with authority and get back to you in 2 weeks. So those kinds of matters are so critical. And often I find, particularly with corporate disputes, that a principal party, the CEO, the CFO, the director of employee relations, isn't going to be at the mediation table, but at least they have to be available.
I don't know if our listeners remember David Letterman and his top 10 list that he used to do in his show. I would always look forward to those. But these two presenters created a top 10 mistakes mediation advocates might make. And it was in one of your slides. I have it in front of me if you don't. But I definitely wanted to do the top 10 as for takeaways for our audience.
Well, Kwame and I both have the list of the clever outline, which says the 10 mistakes.
I want to hear that. Let's do these 10 mistakes.
Just by coincidence, we have that in our respective hands.
Excellent.
But frankly, a number of them we've already discussed, so I don't know if we have to go into a lot of detail, but if you think we do, just let us know. But the inadequate preparation we've already talked about, wrong parties in the room we just got through talking about.
Number three,
not letting the principal speak. And we talked about that, getting the witness.
Number four.
Building working relationships with the mediator and the other side.
Number five.
Actively, which we talked about. Not taking advantage of mediator confidentiality.
Number seven,
funny you should mention that. Inability to separate the party's perceptions and emotions from its position and underlying interests. Failure to explore creative settlement options with the mediator.
Number nine,
ignoring the best alternative to a negotiated agreement, making sure the other side knows that you have an option to an agreement. That's one that you leave to the end and maybe to break an impasse. And then
the number 10 reason, or the number really 10 mistake that mediation advocates might make is
that they lack patience and perseverance. You need to have patience because you have figured it out as the mediator, or even the advocate has figured it out as the mediation advocate. The client hasn't totally digested it yet, and rushing him will encourage either a no or I'll think about it and get back to you next week.
Well, was there anything about your underlying presentation that either of you felt we didn't get to talk about today? Give you another.
You did a pretty good job of covering everything, covering the main things. Yeah.
Well, here's a bit that I'd like to try at the end of every one of our podcasts, and it's called Two for Me and One for You. So there'll be two questions that I'll ask to you, the presenters, and one question that they will have for you, the audience, as kind of a pop quiz to see if you are paying attention today. So we'll start with Kwame. What's an interesting and relatively brief mediation-related story you can share?
Oh, yes. So this one talks about the fallibility of memory. And so with argumentation in general, I have a rule for myself where if my argument is based on an undocumented memory where I don't have anything else to substantiate the existence of it, then I'm probably not arguing over anything worthwhile. and so that's just my rule of thumb. Personally, I don't argue over memory. I just try to figure out what I need to get the other person to do or what I want out of this interaction. Now, the reason why that's relevant here is because my mediation story is a mediation where the party involved was 94 years old. unrepresented. She had her daughter in with her, but that was it. And one of the major issues that they were having was that the person who was on the other side, who she was accusing of doing all these things, because they didn't have permission, they came and they told me in shuttle diplomacy, we did have permission. She told us multiple times, but she forgets all the time. And so it was a really tough situation because they couldn't agree because they did not have a clear record of what has actually transpired. So the takeaway there is to create a paper trail. And if you find yourself in a situation where you're arguing over memory, where you believe your memory is correct and they believe their memory is correct, recognize that this is just going to turn into a war of attrition, and it's probably not going to be very productive.
Very good. Thank you. Professor Lawrence, what's an interesting mediation-related story you can share with us?
Well, I have two favorites. The one is a mediator that was trying to get two conservative synagogues, both of which were in financial distress, to merge together. And at the first meeting, the mediator was asking for their views about important matters. How do you deal with what the wearing apparel is? One side said, everybody has to wear a hat. The other person from the other, a conservative synagogue, said, no one has to wear a hat. When do you bring out the Torah? We bring it out here. No, we bring it out there. What is the rule about how you deal with the various verses of the Bible? And they disagreed. And this went on for an hour and 15 minutes. And at the end, the mediator said, I am so impressed with the progress that we made at this first session. All of you came to the session. You set up an agenda. You gave your views about important issues that are in front of your congregation. I am so impressed with your willingness to follow that agenda and express your views to the other side. We have done wonderfully for this hour and a half, and I know that we're all looking forward to our meeting next Thursday. And we call that finding the 1% that we can agree to. And everybody was agreeing that that all happened. And that was the 1%. And that's what encouraged them to come to a second meeting, et cetera. And after 8 or 9 meetings, it was resolved and the two congregations merged.
Did you say you had a second one?
I do have a second one. I'll try to make it even shorter. A basketball coach, a woman's basketball coach, was fired by the university. She had a winning season, have won 2 national tournaments for the college, but she was fired and was angry as angry can be. And no progress was being made. She was so angry and wanted so much money as punishment for her being fired for no good reason, having a fabulous team which she coached. And finally, the mediator came up with, what kind of credit has she been given for what she accomplished as coach? There was no answer. The mediator then said, what about some thought about giving her that credit? And all of a sudden, the college said, we're planning on building a new gym. We're willing to name it in her honor as the coach for what she has accomplished for the school. That knowledge coming to the coach and her attorney was so valuable to her that she would be recognized for her accomplishments that the dollar value, which was out of the ballpark, became a very reasonable and acceptable number for the sides to agree upon. And it worked out because she was being recognized for her talent, not for her disagreement with higher administration at the school, having nothing to do with her coaching skills.
Next question is, Kwame, who is an amazing person you know related to mediation or negotiation, and why do you appreciate them?
Oh, well, I guess the obvious one is Jim, but I'm going to have to go with somebody else. I would say, this is a tough one. I'd say Professor Nancy Rogers from OSU, former Ohio Attorney General. And she just has been an incredible advocate for alternative dispute resolution throughout her career too. So I think it would be obviously Jim, because he's the person who got me into this. But if I have to extend beyond the present company, I would say Dean Rogers.
Thank you. And how about for you, Professor Lawrence?
Well, part of it is the person who I was talking about in the matter involving the synagogue, because I was not the mediator. It is the person who, Dick Friedman, who was the mediator, who had that talent to build trust at that first meeting by seeing that with all their disagreements, which were 100% disagreements, literally, I wasn't making that up, that he saw the 1% that would get them encouraged to go to another meeting, and built his own trust with both sides that there was value in what each of them had done at that first meeting. And that is such a skill to have and to communicate in a sincere manner so that it would be believed by both sides.
Now we have two professor educators with us today, so I'll leave it between the two of you to decide who gets to give the audience a knowledge check. What's a pop quiz question they should be able to answer after listening to your podcast?
I think a good question for them is, what are some ways that you can break through impasse in your mediations?
Thank you very much. All right. Well, any closing remarks from either one of you before we sign off today?
What was the last of the 10 mistakes that the mediator needs to be patient, be willing to let things be digested with the hope that agreement will be reached at that session or a session hopefully following the next day. So there's not a lot of what we like to call buyer's remorse in another context. And the willingness to stick to it and convince the parties of the value of sticking to it.
Well, I'd like to thank both of our hosts today, our presenters, Kwame Christian and James Lawrence, for joining us today and telling us all about attorney advocacy. And thank you to our listeners for tuning in today, and for all of you who are out there working for justice. Thank you so much.